Welcome. It's February 8th, which is my oldest daughter's birthday. February 8th, and this is the Board of Public Works. We are delighted to be joined by Governor Harry Hughes, whose likeness has changed not one iota from that dashing figure that adorns this room. Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, any opening thoughts?
Not this morning.
Controller?
I completely agree with you. In fact, he looks younger than the portrait. Yeah. So.
He always looked better than that picture.
Governor, I just want to mention that Pennsylvania has its Punxsutawney Phil that comes out. We in Western Maryland have Murray the Groundhog, who has made his appearance and predicted six more weeks of winter. Maybe a little unsentimental, but February means to me not Groundhog's Day or President's Day or even Valentine's Day, but a beginning of a very busy season collecting taxes for the comptroller's office. And now that we've gotten to that point in the year where Marylanders are preparing to pay their taxes, I'd like to take just a minute of the board's time and this morning and highlight the way our office is operating more efficiently and more taxpayer-friendly and more green. When I took office, I vowed to increase the number of Marylanders who file electronically. I was told that this was going to meet a lot of resistance, but I'm happy to report that we've made tremendous progress and 70% of all Marylanders are going to file electronically. Which is almost double what it was 5 years ago. It's why are they doing it? It's safer, more secure for the taxpayer. It saves the state almost $2 per return. That's $2.5 million that we save to support our priorities at a time when we're stretched thin. Over 26 million pages of paper are not wasted because of the electronic filing. We've generated over $1 million in savings and rebates through improved paperless payment programs. My goal is to be virtually paperless by 2014, 100% paper-free, not at the expense of quality government service, but in a more efficient way to achieve it. It's not about making draconian cuts on the services people rely upon. It's about reforming the way we spend public money to ensure we can afford the priorities we share. In addition to electronic filing, we encourage direct deposits of tax refunds and also pay our vendors by direct deposit. Additional paperless ways we're doing business. And we're taking our effort to go green another step further. Rather than continuing to incur the expense of printing out an excessive number of tax booklets each year, we've instated a policy this year of printing out and mailing paper tax returns only to those households that filed by paper last year. And next year, we're not even going to do that. We're going to ask all of those Marylanders to go online and print out, if they choose to file by paper, which I hope they don't, but if they choose to, they can go online next year and print out the paper. This is a solution that will allow our office to reduce expenses and further our commitment to the environment. It will also save the state $250,000. In addition, instead of printing out random numbers of copies to ship to public libraries, any library can now request a CD-ROM of Maryland tax forms to print out when they get requests from their library visitors. In any case, these forms will be available for any Marylander who wants to go to the comptroller's website and print them out. But as we continue our efforts to achieve taxpayer savings and improve the efficiency of our service delivery and become more sustainable, we remain ever dedicated to providing Maryland taxpayers with the highest level of customer service possible. Thank you, Governor.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. All right, let's dive right into the agenda, and let's begin with the item that Governor Hughes is here for, and that would be on which agenda item?
Item 17 on the Secretary's agenda, by Secretary of General Services, Al Collins, is going to introduce the item for us.
Introduce the item, Governor.
Secretary Collins.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. I'm very pleased today to recommend to this board that we rename the Jeff Free Building at 16 Francis Street, rename that building to the Fred L. Wineland Building. Mr. Wineland is here with us today with his family. Let me just note a few things about him, Governor. Item 17 obviously lays out how tremendous this public servant has been, is, and has been, and all the great things he's done. Let me note that he is the former Secretary of State, having done that job for 11 years, the longest serving Secretary of State. I notice also he's a two-term chair of the National Association of States, Secretaries of State. He was a member of the House and a member of the Senate. He's the longest serving member of the Maryland Port Commission, which I also found very interesting in his past history. A World War II veteran and was the chair of the Vietnam Veterans of Maryland Commission. And I could go on and on and on. But Mr. Wine is an outstanding citizen, and it's my pleasure to recommend that we rename that building to the Fred L. Wineland Building.
Governor Hughes, do you want to speak to this item?
Thank you, Governor. Fred Wineland has been a friend of mine for longer than I'd like to remember. And I want to. Governor Clendenning was hoping to be here this morning, but I think he's on the West Coast doing something. I don't know what. But,
we do have a letter from Governor Clendenning.
Yes, I do, which I was going to read, but I don't think I will. You've got it in the record, and you've already heard most of what is in the letter anyway. But I'm here to recommend very highly the naming of the Jeffrey Building. Why it's named the Jeffrey Building, I just learned this morning, and I'm glad they're taking the name off. naming it after Fred Wineland. Fred and I served together in the General Assembly in the Maryland Senate for several years. Then he was treasurer during the, or secretary, excuse me, of state during my 8 years as governor. Most of them, I think, the last couple of years we haven't.
Although he did serve in the House of Delegates before.
He did serve in the House of Delegates before serving in the Senate. I didn't mean to ignore the House of Delegates. Former delegate Nancy Cobb. But it is my pleasure and honor to recommend the naming of the Jeffrey Building after Fred Wineland, very well deserved. And there's someone else I think I should mention in addition to Governor Clendenning, who really started this, is Mike Canning, who's sitting back here, who had the good fortune to work for me for many years. He won't admit that, but it's true. And so with that, Governor, I don't think there's any point in taking any more time, but I think it might be nice to hear from Senator Wineland himself. And
I agree.
Here, Sandy. Introduce to Sandy. Would this letter be in the record, please?
Yes, sir. We have before us a letter from Governor Clendenning, dated February 7, 2012, in which he adds to Governor Hughes's eloquent testimony, and he urges that this building, I greatly appreciate your support for the naming of the office Secretary of State's building after Fred. I look forward to the dedication. So, Mr. Secretary of State, Senator.
Thank you. Governor Malley and my favorite comptroller, as well as my fellow member of the House of Delegates, Nancy Cobb. I was stunned when I got this news, a call from Governor Clendenning. And I'm flying so high, I have to bring my own oxygen. I know, Secretary Collins, that you use a little oxygen at times yourself.
Yes,
and I think somebody told you that I was a pilot for 4,000 hours. That's untrue. It's only 2,000. But I'm truly honored to have this building named after me, something I never thought about, really. And I strongly suspect that my youngest son, Kirk, and Mike Canning, who's upheld by his wife, or he probably couldn't get out of bed in the morning. I've known him forever. But I think this is a wonderful place, and I stayed here for 20 years, and I can't say that I had a really bad day, and I don't want to take up any more of your time, but I'd like to introduce my family, Secretary Collins. I thought you suggested that, and I was away for so much that I sometimes forgot the name of my children. I now find I have difficulty in remembering the names of my grandchildren. But let me start, as I did with my wife, and ask her, how's son number one? Would son number one stand my... My son, David Wynan, a former many, many years ago employee of the state of Maryland, and his son sitting next to him, Jesse Wynan, and my number two son, William Wynan, and his wife, Anne, and my granddaughter, Jessica Wynan, who I might say that when she was born, she was so beautiful that I wrote a song about her, and if I wasn't hoarse, I'd sing it for you. I now get to my daughter, Gail, who loved us dearly, but went off to Denver and married, and then went to get her master's degree down at Emory. And it was a difficult time for her. And I'll say this because my wife told me this. She told my wife, after marriage, working in a pizza shop and going to school, that when she came home at night, she put her head under the pillow, cried, and thought about the good old days. And she's had good days ever since then. I have 8 grandchildren. They're scattered all over the place, and just the two are here today. I want to again thank Governor Hughes. It was a privilege and an honor to serve under him and to work with Governor Glenn Denning and work for him. Governor, I thank you very much, and I'll sit down now, and we'll slip away just as soon as this concludes.
Mr. Secretary,
I forgot my number three son. Well, I've done that before, and my wife would say, "What about number three?" I'd say, "What's his name? Where is Kirk?"
Kirk, that means he loves you the best. Don't tell the others. Well, I have a proclamation that I will incorporate into a motion here. Fred Wynan served our state for more than 40 years in elected and appointed capacities with the highest degree of ethics and concern for our citizens' well-being. And whereas Fred Wynan is Maryland's longest-serving Secretary of State, serving a total of 11 years from 1971 to 1982, as a veteran of World War II, where he served in the Pacific Theater as a member of the United States Navy, Mr. Wynan was elected and served as a member of the House of Delegates from 1963 to 1965, and in the State Senate from 1965 to 1971. And Mr. Wynan continued his commitment to America's veterans and our country by serving as chair of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Commission, the World War II Veterans Commission, and as a driving force in the creation and operation of the Maryland Veterans Cemetery Program. And Mr. Wynan served on the Maryland Port Commission longer than anyone else, knowing the incredible importance of the Port of Baltimore to the economic well-being of our state. In that capacity, he became an international ambassador for Maryland and contributed significantly to the creation of our modern and competitive facilities that generate such great returns for jobs and opportunities in Maryland. Mr. Wynan's service as a lifelong member of the Allentown Road Volunteer Fire Department demonstrates his commitment to his local community and his passion and dedication on behalf of Maryland. He also served as a 2-time chairman of the National Association of Secretaries of State and has received multiple awards on a local, state, and national level for his genuine leadership and invaluable public service to our state and nation. Now, therefore, I, Martin O'Malley, Governor of the State of Maryland, do hereby move item 17 on the Secretary's agenda. That will name the Jeffrey Building, located at 1618 and 26 Francis Street in the city of Annapolis, be known forevermore as the Fred L. Wynan Building. Is there a second?
Second.
Second.
Seconded simultaneously by the secretary and, I mean, by the comptroller and also the treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? It's unanimous, Fred. Congratulations to you. Thank you. Why don't you bring your family up here? We'll do a picture and let you guys go to lunch. And Governor Hughes and...
He's going.
I think you want to come around this. Can somebody clear a pathway here? How's it going? This is fun. You going to make him take you to lunch? Good. Governor, come on up. Everybody squeeze in. It'll feel unnatural, but it'll look good. Make sure Jay can see your picture.
If you'll take a second to your right, please. Great. Okay, everybody's in. Okay. Congratulations. Right this way. Okay, looks great. Once again. Very good. Okay, you're all set. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Congratulations. Hey, you're very welcome. Thank you. Beautiful family. Thanks a lot, Linda. Thanks. All right. Any other items on the secretary's agenda?
Yeah, I have a. I do have an item.
Comptroller?
Yes.
Okay.
I'd like to just call item 16.
Okay, item 16. This is one of the 17 items that we have on the agenda with one emergency report. Item 16 is Public School Construction Program, Western Region. Dr. David Weaver is here from Public School Construction Program, but I believe he has a representative with him from Western Maryland that could help answer your questions.
Okay.
David, you want to introduce yourself and introduce your representatives, please?
Yes, good morning. We have with us today representatives Mr. Vince Montana from Allegheny County Public Schools, Mr. William Kane from Carroll County Public Schools, and Mr. Al Albacher from Carroll County Public Schools.
Thank you.
And if you have any questions, be glad to answer them.
Well, actually, I don't have any questions, but I don't really have any problems with the priority projects that are being presented. I believe that all five of the school districts that are represented in this request have a well-deserved reputation for sound fiscal management and a commitment to effective school maintenance, which I consider to be very important. I was just out in Washington County earlier this week to visit Vester Elementary School in Hagerstown. In the last public school maintenance survey that was published in 2010, Washington County had 8 schools surveyed at random. 3 of them achieved a superior rating. Not bad when you compare it to some of the big counties that have 25, 30 schools randomly inspected and end up, if they're lucky, with one superior rating. So congratulations to Washington County. Allegheny County had only 3 schools surveyed, and 2 of them were ranked superior. I do find that many of our smaller rural jurisdictions, where there isn't that critical mass of taxable wealth and money, has historically been very tight, are especially tight with taxpayer dollars, are especially committed to taking care of what they already have. I admire and applaud it. I believe it should be rewarded, Dr. Lieber, and I appreciate all your good efforts to underline the importance. But seeing Garrett County's request come in front of us reminds me of another issue that I'd like to raise briefly. I've watched with considerable interest how the public school calendar has evolved in recent years. There was a time, not that long ago, when the school year wouldn't begin until after Labor Day. I'm sure there were some downsides that weren't apparent to folks like me, but I can tell you what it did mean to me to hold off school until that Tuesday or Wednesday after Labor Day. It meant that young families could enjoy those last few days of summer as a family, stay a few extra days down at the beach, out at Deep Creek Lake, take that last Labor Day vacation without having to work around the academic calendar. Meant that small businesses at the beach, up in the mountains, and throughout the state, which are still the heart and soul of the Maryland economy, could keep their seasonal health just a little while longer to help get through the end of summer rush. Meant that businesses in summertime tourist destinations like Ocean City and Deep Creek Lake could enjoy an even more prosperous end of summer boom before their businesses begin to slow down for the fall and winter. I'm not sure when all these things began to change or why, but I look at the calendar now and I see that all 24 of our school systems come back in the month of August. Some, like Prince George's, Dorchester, Anne Arundel, open nearly 2 weeks before Labor Day, which is prime time for a tourism-oriented state like ours. I can only imagine the amount of money that's being lost in tourist destinations around our state. I can only imagine the burden that's placed on countless small business owners who have to scramble to cover the workload left behind by their seasonal staff. Most of all, I can only imagine how irritating it would be for a lot of folks who would like to take that week-long end-of-summer vacation but can't because their kids are already back in school. All of this is to say that I would really like to see the state of Maryland and its 24 school systems re-examine this trend towards early school openings. I understand our public school students under law are required to complete 180 school days each year. Pushing back the date the kids come back in the fall would obviously push back the date the kids get out in the summer. I also understand I might be risking the votes of a lot of parents who, by the end of August, frankly, are more than ready to send them back to school. In all seriousness, I think this is something that requires another look. I would think there's enough flexibility in the academic calendar to accommodate a change of this nature without extending the academic calendar out too long. I would personally start by revisiting the length of the annual holiday break, but that's just me. And while there may be issues that I'm not aware of and which I'm sure I'll hear about now, I really believe this would be a change for the better for young families and small businesses around our state. And I think Norman Rockwell would appreciate it, the family value and wonderful Labor Day, what Labor Day represented to all of us growing up, which was the end of summer and the start of school. Dr. Lieber, that has nothing to do with you, but I'm pleased that you,
thank you.
Came up, and I'll revisit this down the road, but thank you for your service to our state, particularly on the school maintenance issue, which I...
Thank you for your words.
Controller moves approval of item 16, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? Ayes have it. Anything else on the balance? Thank you, gentlemen. On the balance of the Secretary's agenda.
I would point out, Governor, item number six is a notice of the bond sale that we have scheduled to be held the first week in March. As you know, the Board of Public Works has to pass a resolution establishing the bond sale, and then as we get closer to the date, we can be absolutely certain, looking at market conditions, exactly what the size will be. But the amount of new money bonds right now in item number six is proposed to be $600 million, and that's for two reasons. It's a little more than usual. This is issuance, not new authorization. But how, when we go out to get the money to pay for what's already been authorized, first of all, we are spending the money more quickly. We are building more quickly and finishing building more quickly, so obviously creating jobs and stimulating the economy, which is a very good thing. Over the last 6 months, we've averaged over $95 million a month. And all the proceeds, therefore, from the last sale have been spent, mostly, I would say, on school and education buildings, but on the range of state responsibilities as well. The other reason for doing it is that interest rates are at a historic low level, so it makes more sense to issue bonds when you can essentially buy the money more cheaply and build more quickly. We also are going to go ahead, as we have in the last few sales, and have a couple of days first of retail sale aimed specifically at individual Maryland investors, not the large institutions. There is more and more demand for that. As I mentioned at the last bond sale, we seem to see people recognizing a good deal and the flight to quality from even U.S. bonds to Maryland bonds was quite obvious last time. We propose to allocate $150 million to the retail part of Series A. That would be March 2nd, and which is a Friday, and perhaps going over to the 5th, a Monday, depending on how the market goes. We also, and then the rest of it will be new money on the next Wednesday, as it has been in the past, competitively sold in public. We invite everybody to come and watch the sale. We believe we would do extremely, extremely well. The other thing is that because of low interest rates at the moment, we are constantly combing our present portfolio to find opportunities to refund bonds at a lower interest rate and reduce debt. Last year, we were able to net out a savings to the taxpayers of about $11 million through refunding. We propose selling in this resolution, it says up to $500 million, because we really don't know until you see the market conditions very close to the time of sale exactly how much you can sell. But based on current market conditions, we would save over $30 million in future debt service costs going to the market with $500 million. Whatever it is, we will gain, I believe, several million dollars, which will then go into the bond annuity fund to help pay the debt service on future debt sales and build the schools that we need. That's item number 6, Governor, and I would propose that the board today endorse the sale, and I will be back to you with more information at the next meeting.
So the Treasurer moves approval of item number 6, seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. And now, is there anything else in the balance of the Secretary's agenda? Hearing none. Comptroller moves approval of the balance of the Secretary's agenda, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We now move on. I know we have an item on, that was deferred from last time on Department of Budget Management agenda. I'm sorry, we got open space? All right, I'm getting ahead of ourselves. We got open space, my favorite part of the agenda.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Lisa Ward for the Department of Natural Resources. Today we have two items on our agenda.
Any questions? The Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. I'm going to skip over DBM and go. We'll come back to you shortly. Go to the University System of Maryland. Any question on the University System of Maryland agenda items?
We are withdrawing item 9C, by the way.
Well, you could have gotten it passed. All right. Item 9C is withdrawn. Item 9C is withdrawn. Any questions on the balance of the University System of Maryland agenda items? Hearing none, Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. Thank you. We move on to the Department of Information Technology. Secretary of IT, Elliot Schlanger. Reporting.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Ellie Schlanger, Department of IT. We have two items on the agenda this morning. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Hearing none. Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it.
Thank you.
Move on now to the Department of Transportation. Madam Secretary.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, Beverly Swain Staley representing MDOT. We have 8 items today, and item 4 has been revised. We're happy to answer your questions.
Any questions? Hearing none, Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. We now move to the Department of General Services.
Sir. Again, Governor, good morning. Al Collins, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 12 items on our agenda. We want to note items 1 and 12 have been revised. Also, Governor, I'd like to point out joining us this morning on item 1 is Secretary Gary Maynard. This is a two-part request on behalf of the board concerning the Maryland House of Corrections. Part one is to request permission of the board to approve demolition of the 16 existing buildings. And part B of our agenda item is to approve the engineering services, the firm represented to draw up the plans for that demolition. Governor, I think this is a part of a public safety strategy that's been long coming, and we're ready to move this item forward on behalf of
Mr. Secretary, Secretary Maynard, General Maynard. General Maynard, I understand that you received an award of national distinction recently.
Yes, sir.
And what was that award?
That was the Edward R. Cass Award given by the American Correction Association.
And that's an award that is given by your peers? Or
It's given by the American Correction Association. It's about 24,000 members across the country, and so it comes from that group.
Good. Secretary Maynard's very humble and unassuming. This is probably the highest professional honor in our country where corrections is concerned, and we're very, very proud of the job you're doing, and by extension, proud that you received that award, which I know you claim only on behalf of the hardworking men and women of the Department of Public Safety and
Corrections Services.
And your wife.
Very, very true.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
So what are we doing here? This is the House of Corrections.
Yes, sir.
Closed in the first 52 days of this administration.
There are two agenda items. One is to request permission to demolish the House of Corrections that was closed in 2007. It's remained vacant. The second is to request approval for an engineering firm to engineer and design the deconstruction of that facility. We looked at demolition of the facility initially, and the cost estimate was in excess of $10 million just to demolish it, take it to the landfill. We started looking at deconstruction techniques and how we might use inmate labor to help deconstruct, and the price went way down. Plus, we will recycle a lot of materials, keep it out of the landfill, train a lot of inmates, develop apprenticeships, and improve the employability of inmates leaving our system. I expect we will probably train in that project at Jessup using inmates from JCI, probably 150 inmates that will be trained in asbestos abatement, lead paint abatement, deconstruction techniques, forklift operation, skid loader operation, and safety, OSHA safety, all of that.
Gary, could these be skills that that the inmates would be able to use when they return to neighborhoods?
Absolutely. We did have a meeting yesterday, just this group of deconstruction stakeholders around.
Man, I would have loved to have been there.
These
are people that do this in the private sector.
Well, there were a lot of representation from nonprofits who want to provide training for inmates. There were representation from the unions, from the Painters Association, and from asbestos folks, and they are very interested in fact, the painter union person told me, who's the lead paint expert, he said he can't get people for apprenticeships. He wants to set up apprenticeships there for inmates, pre-apprenticeships, over 200 hours of training, and when they leave, they'll be very, very employable. He said he can't find enough people that are trained in lead paint abatement, in the same way with asbestos abatement. So there'll be a lot of really good training, and the nonprofits are there because we can't include in the contract for deconstruction, we can't include the inmate training portion. So the nonprofits are going to provide the training for us, and that will amount to about $150,000, and they said yesterday that's a very easy number to get, and they're all excited about that. So
that's great.
It's a great program.
You know, sometimes back in those days when we had the dollars to do than the demolition in the city of Baltimore, which has all the infrastructure to accommodate higher and growth at greater density. But, it, you know, there's old buildings, vacant, abandoned.
Absolutely.
In the way, would these sorts of skills be the sort of things that we might be able to do at a more impactful scale, say as inmate labor project, to remove vacancies?
In fact, we have for years in the city of Baltimore been working with Habitat for Humanity because they do some deconstructing of old row homes and they reconstruct others out of the salvage material. There's a lot of national interest in this. This would be the very largest deconstruction project that inmate labor has been involved in the country. And there is no question about if we do this, we salvage this material, and there's a lot of salvageable material, the slate roof, the stone, the copper, the steel. There's 1,000 cells. Each of those has a steel front and a sliding bar door that's probably 1,000 pounds. So there's a lot of steel in there that can be salvaged. Once we do that, we could move with a trained crew to other state agencies, Department of Juvenile Services, vacant buildings. Hinterton is a good example of a facility that's been sitting there and needs to be deconstructed.
Rosewood,
Springfield, a lot of those, yes, sir.
Not to mention the vacants that face the railroad right away going through the city of Baltimore.
Right. A lot of work, and it's a skill that inmates. Deconstruction is sort of the new construction technique and green construction.
More sustainable.
Right. Very much.
Sustainable deconstruction.
Right.
It's exciting.
That's actually very exciting. Yeah.
Have you met with anybody at the city of Baltimore yet? I guess not.
We've had conversations, yes, but they haven't gone very far yet. We have done some work in some row homes, certainly in Baltimore.
Yeah, I would think Commissioner Graziano,
I've talked to him.
Cost effective, less expensive than demolition?
Absolutely.
Not to mention dumping whole houses in the landfill.
Absolutely. The estimate for demolition and bulldozing and taking the landfill was in excess of $10 million. This deconstruction cost with the recycling and resale of materials would be, I guess it's up to $7 million, but it's $3 or $4 million less than just bulldozing it, plus all the skill training, plus the recycling, plus keeping it out of landfill.
That's a great story.
That is. It's going to be great.
If there's any reporters in the audience, that might be a good one. You wouldn't even have to mention my name in it. You could just say something that Carrie thought of. But you did. There's so much good work that you're doing on the restorative justice front.
Thank you.
And I got your calendar.
Good.
And it was really good stuff. I mean,
the oyster
aquaculture, the forestry program,
yes, sir.
So many of the projects that you've been able to do, even in these times of cuts and austerity, to keep our fellow men and women in our state who are inmates for this time of their lives.
They want to work. I mean, it's really our obligation to find them work to do and training. They all, 99%, want to work, want to do better, want to get out and be successful. So.
More trees.
Are you building into your programs any sort of follow-up?
Yes.
After?
Yes. Yes. A lot of our programs have built-in follow-up programs.
So you can judge how well the different programs have worked and shaped them.
Absolutely. Part of the training of this deconstruction project will be follow-up specifically to this project. And again, I think Jessup Correctional Institution, 1,700 inmates just sitting right half a block away from this project, will probably use in excess of, I mean, I've been using the number 150 inmates that would be trained. The painters union yesterday, the lead paint people said, we're talking about 250 people it will take to do this project, inmates. So the contract will have a private company with private employees, and then they will see that the training, the safety training, the apprenticeship training, all of that takes place. It will be a large number of inmates that are affected by this, and there will be follow-up, yes.
This is the best facility we ever closed.
True. Well, the good thing about it, Governor, is, if you can imagine, one of the worst prisons in the country, one of the most violent, and inmates having an opportunity to deconstruct that, take that prison down at the same time learning skills that make him employable. So it's really a good story.
Probably something healing in the deconstruction itself.
Absolutely.
And assaults against correctional officers since that closed have continued to...
Cut in half, yes, sir.
Go down, cut in half. All right. Any other questions on the balance of DGS agenda items? The Comptroller moves approval.
Governor, I would, not a question, but point out that Delegate Jim Proctor was here earlier, had to go down to the session to testify in support of item number 9, just to register his and his community's support of the National Park and Planning Commission's field lights project in Prince George's.
It's a grant in Long Island.
Okay. All right. Treasurer moves approval, seconded by the Comptroller. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? Aye. The ayes have it. And that was Department of General Services. We now return to our originally scheduled programming. Department of Budget Management. I know that we have the issue we deferred from last time regarding one of the larger contracts we ever do, which is for the pharmacy benefits plan. Are there any other items, holding that one aside for 1 second? Any other concerns about the balance of the Department of Budget Management agenda items?
Currently, there are 6 items on the department's agenda. Item 1 is the pharmacy benefits management contract, and that's the item that was deferred at the January 25th meeting of the board.
Gotcha. Any other questions on DBM agenda? Mr. Comptroller.
I think the treasurer mentioned to me a concern about item 6.
Item six
is a settlement in the Rosetta Dempsey case versus the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene. And we have Christopher Dobson from the Attorney General's Office.
Good morning, Governor.
I'm not
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. Chris Gosdor, Assistant Attorney General, on behalf of the Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, and also if the board would have questions for DHMH itself, programmatic or clinical questions, if Dr. Gail Jordan Randolph here, and also on behalf of the plaintiff's counsel that is in support of the board approving this measure is Jonathan Foote.
Okay. Was it pulled out of there? Okay. All right, any questions?
Yeah, no, we received a letter at the last minute from the Dorchester branch of the NAACP and also the Maryland State Conference NAACP president, Mrs. Stansbury, asking that this be deferred for 2 weeks, and take it you wouldn't have a problem with that to a future board meeting.
We are. The Attorney General's office is prepared to go forward today, but we would not object to the board exercising its prerogative to table the measure.
And, Governor, I'm not doing it other than the fact that I rarely hear from Mr. Stansbury, but he is the president of a statewide conference. I'm not suggesting there's any merit to this. I'm just saying, as a courtesy, we probably should defer. But, Madam Treasurer, I don't know whether that's if I'm putting words in your mouth, I apologize if I am, but I would prefer that we delay for 2 weeks just as a courtesy to this statewide organization.
Well, I was not proposing that, but if that is what you wish, and if it would give my understanding, having studied the papers that we have, is that this is a case which has taken a great deal of time, which has been signed off by an agreement between the plaintiffs and the attorneys, the plaintiffs and their attorneys, and the attorneys and the Attorney General's office, and approved by 2 different levels of federal judges. But if there are questions that remain unanswered, either to the members of the board, since we have only just seen it, or if there are things you can explain to the NAACP that they don't know, I guess 2 weeks would give them time. I at the moment am prepared to support this item now or in 2 weeks.
And I, in all likelihood, will support it in 2 weeks, but I think it's appropriate to...
Have they called you before they sent this letter and said we want to talk to you about this or anything, the AG's office?
They have not, Your Honor.
All right. Can you make yourself available to them?
Yes.
Over these next 2 weeks for any questions they may have? Are the plaintiff's lawyers here who are trying to set this aside? Did they come today, or did they just get the NAACP to send away?
I have not seen them, Your Honor.
My understanding is the plaintiff's lawyer who's been representing them, is that you, sir?
Yes. Mr. Puth,
please. Endorses this settlement.
Do you want to be heard from, sir? I'm sorry. I thought that there were other lawyers trying to set it aside or something.
Governor, thank you very much. My name is Jonathan Puth of Webster, Frederickson, Korean Puth. We've been very privileged to represent Rosetta Denby and Shirley Williams. We've litigated this case quite thoroughly and engaged in extensive discovery in the case. In 2010, given the concerns regarding the capacity of these intellectually disabled individuals to fully appreciate the risks and rewards of going forward, the district court, United States District Court of Maryland, appointed a guardian ad litem in the case, Mr. David Furlinger, who is a lifelong advocate for the intellectually disabled, who served as a guardian ad litem. A settlement was reached with the state, which I believe is very robust and generous and appropriate in this case, given the risks and rewards. After the court held a hearing on the settlement, at which time the individuals, Ms. Denby and Ms. Williams, were heard, held the hearing on October 26th of 2011 and approved the settlement in November, late November 2011. Since that time, in mid-December, two attorneys representing the individuals did enter an appearance in the case. They have not contacted me. They have not sought to review the record or discuss the risks and rewards of moving forward. A guardian ad litem standing in the shoes of these individuals did produce an extensive report, very thoughtful report, and found the settlement to be very fair to these individuals, was duly appointed. But there's been no movement by these attorneys to seek to set aside the approval of the settlement, to appeal in any way, or to take any other action in court. So this settlement has been approved by the parties, and in an unusual step, because most settlements are not approved by the court, this settlement was approved by the court. And great safeguards and thoughtfulness were put into the matter of the appointment of the guardian ad litem and approval of the settlement after hearing that on behalf of the plaintiffs through the guardian ad litem and in conjunction with the state, we urge approval of the matter. We had heard by letter issued to the court in mid-December. I haven't seen this letter. I imagine it's similar. But since that time, we've just heard nothing from them, nor have they taken any action in court to set aside the matter.
No, my concern is that it comes from, if it were just from Dorchester, I'm not sure I'd request a deferral. Not that Dorchester isn't important, but who knows. But when it comes from Mr. Stansbury, who I have a lot of respect for, who's the president of the statewide conference, and there's extremely strong language here. So I assume that the governor and treasurer and I will prove what the court is and you have come up with, but certainly think that somebody ought to talk to somebody about what's in this letter because the language is so jarring.
Right. And we certainly stand ready to answer any questions of the Board of Public Works, and we're glad to address this at any time.
All right. We're moving to defer for 2 weeks. We apologize for the delay, and sounds like a lot of work's been done in the 5 years leading up to this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Could I just say, I hope you will have an opportunity to explain, because It looks to me, having read the record, that Mr. Sansbury and Mr. Pinkett are not, in fact, aware of everything that has gone and all the work that has gone into this case. I think you have two vulnerable plaintiffs who went through a difficult, very bad, horrible experience. I hope they will not be used by anyone for any purpose, and I look forward to resolving this in 2 weeks.
Thank you.
Appreciate your comments.
So item 6GM, Comptroller moves deferral for 2 weeks, seconded by me. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. That leaves us with the balance of the department, the budget management agenda, holding aside for a second the big pharmacy contract. Any questions on the balance of the Department of Budget Management agenda? Hearing none, Comptroller moves approval, seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye. Aye. All opposed? The ayes have it. And we still have a full room. Huh? All right. Okay, so we are calling item 1S, the long deliberated.
So this is item was that item 1S is the Pharmacy Benefits Management Contract Number 4. This item was deferred at the January 25th meeting to allow time for the board and for the staff members to review the decision of the Board of Contract Appeals. Now that you've had the opportunity to look at this contract over the last 2 weeks, the Department of Budget Management is back today to ask for your approval of the award of the contract to Express Scripts. The award will cover five full plan years in 6 weeks beginning May the 16th. We believe that moving forward with the new contract is in the best interest of the state for several reasons. The contract with Express Scripts is projected to provide in excess of $100 million in savings over the term of the contract to the state. Moving forward on May the 16th, which is the projected start date, if approved by the board, will save us approximately $2 million for the remaining 6 weeks of this fiscal year. In addition, the May 16th start date will give Express Scripts an opportunity to be involved in the state's open enrollment period for the plan year that begins July 2012. And approval of this contract today will allow for a smooth 90-day transition process. In closing, I would just reiterate that Express Scripts was unanimously selected for award after a thorough and fair procurement. The department has concluded that Express Scripts is a responsible offerer whose proposal is most advantageous to the state. We have representatives here today from the department's Employee Benefits Division. We have representatives from the Attorney General's Office, and our consultants, GRS, are here. We're all available to address any questions that you may have. In addition, there are representatives from Express Scripts, Inc. here as well. So with that, we'll be happy to begin to answer and address any issues that the members of the board may have.
Mr. Comptroller.
Thank you, Governor. Thank you, Madam Secretary. And as you stated, we're being asked to award a five-year, $2.4 billion pharmaceutical benefits contract to Express Scripts, which is a nationally known St. Louis-based firm. In so doing, we're being asked to unseat the incumbent vendor, a successful Maryland-based company, which assumed responsibility for this exceedingly complex contract 5 years ago, and who, by all accounts, has carried out its duties exceptionally well. It's probably not a surprise that I have questions about the contract we're being asked to award here today, given the dollars that are at stake and the effect that this decision could have on the well-being of hundreds of thousands of Marylanders, those who subscribe to the state of Maryland's pharmaceutical benefits plan, as well as those people whose livelihoods could be placed in jeopardy if a local firm were to lose a $2.4 billion contract. It's my understanding that according to the original RFP that was distributed to prospective vendors, cost and technical considerations would be given equal weight. According to the background materials I've read, Catalyst RX, the incumbent vendor, which is headquartered right up the road in Rockville, achieved the highest technical score among all the vendors. Furthermore, as DBM's own procurement officer acknowledged in a letter to you, Madam Secretary, dated December 10th, 2010, catalyst fixed costs, its administrative fees, for example, and its paper claim processing and drug utilization review fees would be substantially lower than that of Express Scripts International. And yet apparently DBM chose to award this contract to Express Scripts primarily on the expectation that ESI, the St. Louis-based company, could ultimately achieve cost savings through, quote, lower ingredient costs, end quote. My first question is this. Where did you get the idea that ESI could provide lower ingredient costs? An opinion that was issued by the Board of Contract Appeals on the bid protest, authored by a former delegate, Dana Dembro, who is extraordinarily smart lawyer himself, I thought did a really outstanding job in drafting his opinion. But in that opinion, he states on page 73 that, quote, the precise mode of tabulation of ingredient cost estimates is not fully disclosed in written GRS reports, that's your consultant, I think, or any oral testimony concerning that work. Indeed, he states on page 43 that, quote, notwithstanding ESI's superior offer of minimum guaranteed discount, ESI's historical average of actual ingredient costs used to calculate the state's future liability is higher than Catalyst, and that ESI's actual drug ingredient costs for 2008-2009 were higher than Catalyst in all three tiers of drug categories, single-source, multi-source brand, and generic. So, I guess in plain English, here's what's happened as far as I can tell. DBM solicits bids for a contract, promises to give technical and cost considerations the same amount of weight. Catalyst is better on technical, also came in cheaper on all those costs that we can actually measure, all those fixed costs. But DBM's poised to award the contract to this St. Louis-based company on the basis of a single cost determinant, despite the fact there's apparently nothing in writing to back up your assumption, and despite the fact that Catalyst has historically come in cheaper on that as well. And I think right at the outset, I guess I'd like to get some explanation, because on the surface, it raises the possibility that we're buying a pig in a poke here, where, you know, the history shows that this key item, ingredient cost, Catalyst is delivered at a lower rate than ESI. So we end up on both the technical and the financial. So please help me understand, I guess, the balance between financial and technical issues, and because obviously this is, A, a lot of money, and, B, a lot of disruption potentially to our citizens.
Well, thank you for your long question. But first of all, you're absolutely correct. When this RFP was put out on the street, we said from the beginning that technical and financial would be given equal weight, and that is exactly what we did. Certainly, in looking at the price of these items and looking at the overall cost of the proposal, there were four basic elements that were looked at. We looked at what the administrative fees were going to be. We looked at what the dispensing fees were going to be. We looked at the ingredient costs, and we looked at rebates. And you're absolutely correct. What our consultants and what the team of procurement evaluators found was they found that ESI offered a better minimum guarantee in regard, better than Catalyst in regard to the ingredient costs. I was not a part of the evaluation team, but we do have experts here. I would really like to ask our consultant, who is with GRS, who is Michael Madalino, to come up, along with Ann Timmons, who is head of our employee benefits unit, was a member of the evaluation team, and I'm sure that they can address all of your specific questions in regard to ingredient costs and basically give you some comfort that after their review of the item, that they too agree that ESI had a better price in regard to the ingredient costs. Thank you.
Okay. I appreciate your presence here. Who is Kevin DiStefano?
Actually, we as I explained to your staff yesterday, we have two consultants who we are working with GRS. Kevin is one. He was unavailable today. I explained that. But also, Mr. Madalena works with him. He is quite prepared to address the same questions that Kevin would be.
Okay. So the judge ruled in your favor because the legal standard is arbitrary and capricious, and they couldn't. He said it did not rise to that, but he had some, I think, very troubling statements in there about the lack of either written or oral substance to your claim to us, the state, that there's going to be a 3% or significant savings because of the your determination of ingredient costs. I mean, that's what this whole thing is pinned on. And I guess my question is, Where's the analysis? Is it in writing or?
Well, this RFP included an industry standard financial evaluation model, and that model is what produced the comparative results between the proposals.
Well, yeah, but that's a lot of gobbledygook, if I could just explain. I mean, where is the analysis? Is there a the judge in this case, I mean, he's the one who wrote it. He said, there's no oral or written document or statement that I can look at to make any determination. He said I have to take it on DVM's statement that it's not arbitrary and capricious, so it is legal. But he certainly raised questions as to whether it was right to rely upon consultants who, according to him, you know, there wasn't anything for him to look at. And then, secondly, he brought in this, maybe it's a case that Catalyst is making, that, in fact, when you look at history, the drug ingredient costs of ESI are a lot higher than Catalyst. Is there a possibility you guys are just dead wrong?
If I may, sir.
Yes.
The analysis there, the calculation of what ingredient cost was predicted to be, was an integral part of the spreadsheet that each of the offerors were asked to provide. The way the analysis worked, and is included in as part of the procurement and part of the spreadsheet, where we developed and we gave the offerors a mix of basically the buckets, as it were, of different kinds of drugs. We're asking them to provide guarantees in terms of what kind of discount you would provide for example, at the retail store setting, what generic discount you're guaranteeing, what dispensing fee you're guaranteeing, rebates, all those components were provided to each of the offers. In the analysis, the predicted ingredient cost, or you know, approximately 98% of the cost associated with this benefit or related to ingredient costs were simply the multiplication of the guaranteed discount times the average wholesale price and industry standard methodology for expressing what the top-end cost is for a drug, plus the dispensing fee that the proposer was guaranteeing, less rebates. So it was a product of all that in the spreadsheet that was used for the evaluation, then given to all the offers as part of their response, included that calculation inside of the spreadsheet. So they were able to produce, basically, their own financial result.
So you could compare apples and apples because you, in fact, set up the matrix, essentially?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. And that those data points were based entirely on the claims experience of the group. So in other words, we had the actual mix of brand drugs and generic drugs, mail order, retail, 90-day make. But all of that was based upon the experience of the group as opposed to some sort of standardized benchmarking data set.
But are you surprised by, I'm not sure what I call him, Judge Dembro or whatever his title is, board member. And here's the quote, ESI's actual drug ingredient costs for 2008-2009 were higher than Catalyst in all three tiers of drug categories, single source, multi-source, brand, and generic. How do you compare the perspective with what really happened?
Those numbers were not adjusted for any of the drug mix of each of those. Those were plan design. That was sort of their book of business, and no adjustment was made for that. That, you know, that maybe different kinds of groups have different utilization patterns. The meaningful, in our opinion, the meaningful numbers were ones that were generated by the specific utilization of the group. So those were sort of national unadjusted numbers that didn't really consider any differences in the populations that the companies were serving, any mix of drugs that were being prescribed, specialty medicines, a number of factors were just sort of gross top-line numbers.
And simply self-reported by each of those vendors.
I'm not challenging you guys. I'm just wondering where the work product is, since it was noted by the board member that it was not, he couldn't find any written or oral backup to your conclusions. And that's, it appears to me that that's the entire tip of this upside-down pyramid that we're making a decision on. So it's kind of important. But while I've got you, I got another question about apparently on page 44 of the opinion, Catalyst self-reported 20% of the administrative fees paid by Maryland to achieve its profit, while ESI's bid didn't reflect a profit, even though I quote in, from the opinion, ESI subsequently confidentially disclosed to DBM its average profit per claim. I guess there are two aspects there that bother me. One is that we're not comparing apples to apples. Catalyst baked its profits into its cost model. ESI didn't. Second, there's no evidence to suggest, love to be proven wrong on this from Madam Secretary, that DBM went back to revisit its cost assumptions for ESI even after receiving this information.
Well, the model of this RFP and our contract is 100% pass-through pricing, so they can make no additional money on our account other than what we pay in admin fees. Any rebate, any grant money, any money at all, any revenue stream has to come back to the state.
But after DBM revealed its average profit per claim, that was irrelevant to you guys because we're going to have this information that we will... Who's going to be tracking that, you guys or somebody else? I mean, this is an enormously intricate, complex situation, and I'm just shaking my head at how anybody is held accountable for anything, given the complexity of what we have here. And
well, we hold these vendors extremely accountable. Not only do we have outside contract auditors that will audit the previous plan year in detail, clinical, financial, claims accuracy, and contract adherence, but we also have built into our consulting contract what's called a pharmacy directorship. And so during the plan year, we are monitoring every piece of that pass-through pricing on a quarterly basis so that we can go back to that vendor real time and say, okay, it doesn't look like you're hitting your discounts or this isn't what was part of the contract, and we can begin discussions even before the outside contract auditor sits down.
So you're not impressed that their ingredient costs were higher than Catalyst historically. That doesn't trouble you as far as moving down the road?
No, sir, not without really looking at the book of business and the detailed data that will go behind that calculation. Mm-hmm. I think that in our opinion, as we've move forward with this, we're very comfortable with it in that it's based upon the experience of this group in particular, the 219,000 approximate members who are served by the program. So in that, we're not creating any mismatch between what is being used and what the offers or the vendors are offering us in terms of a price proposal.
Okay. Well, I continue, if I could, and you can stay there if you want, because there may be something else that comes up, but this tension between technical and cost factors, Madam Secretary, you stated that they were even Steven, equally weighted. But the Board of Contracts Appeals opinion points out it's clear in the evaluation phase of the procurement your agency's tendency was to overweight the promise, however tenuous and unsubstantiated, of ESI's cost savings. The spirit of the agency
attitude seems to be summarized in an email by the procurement officer to the members of the evaluation committee, which stated, according to the opinion, quote, with roughly, according to the procurement officer said, according to the opinion, quote, with roughly an estimated $47 million higher expense, I have yet to be convinced that Catalyst RX is the better choice given the current economic budget climate. That sounds to me like we're going to make this decision based on cost and not equally weighted with technical.
Mr. Comptroller, let me reiterate. This proposal was based on 50% on technical and financial being equal, and that's how the department proceeded.
But if Catalyst gave you a proposal that included their profit and ESI didn't, how can you possibly compare those two and say ESI is going to save us money?
I think that the financial model that was used is one that reflects an industry standard. It's an actuarially approved methodology, and it is one that is designed to compare apples to apples.
Okay.
And, you know, this, I think that the consultant, as well as Ms. Timmons, have been pretty clear that we did look at these on an apple-to-apple basis.
Well, I'd love to see some proof of that, because it sure doesn't strike me that you did. The one proposal had the profit in it. The other proposal didn't. Somebody went back and had some kind of confidential discussion and came back and said, even though Catalyst baked in their profit, transparent, countable, the winning bidder, ESI, didn't do it. But we had a conversation with them, and we kind of got, I don't know what, comfortable. And so you're comparing not apples to apples, but you're comparing apples to oranges.
I think you know that as a part of this process, there are written documents that are provided. The members of the evaluation teams review them. It's followed up by having oral presentations with each of the offers. And even there's additional follow-up if the members of the evaluation committee have questions based on subsequent materials that are submitted. So, you know, this is a process that's been going on for over 2 years. Certainly the evaluation team met and worked with each of the offerors over a period of 6 months. So I think during that period they had an opportunity to answer numerous questions. They got satisfactory answers. And in the end, their decision was that Express Scripts provided the best offer for the state.
If I might add just one thing about the way that the offers presented their financial proposals to the state, profit is expected and is in fact built into the administrative fees. There are several places, and I'm going to speak now from like our role in the quarterly review of pharmacy, the pharmacy directorship role. Whoever the vendor is must be, you know, provide basically where their profit centers are. We know where those are. We know that the administrative fee is a source for them to make money. They have the potential to make money in certain other aspects, which are always fully disclosed as part of their agreement. So, in our mind, in our opinion, when we were looking at these offers, any profit built in was indeed built into the administrative fee. And the way that the offers structured their discounts, their guarantees, and such. So, I think it is the way it was evaluated that profit was considered.
Okay, but I'm just relying on what the opinion says that Catalyst self-reported 20% administrative fees as its profit. ESI's bid didn't reflect a profit. That's his words. And it was only some kind of confidential phone call down the road that talking about average profit per claim that you confidentially guys all got together and said, oh, yeah, no, it's even though it's not in their proposal, it's in this conversation, I guess.
Mr. Comptroller, I'm going to ask Bruce Martin, who's our principal counsel, to join our team, and maybe he can elaborate on your question.
Thank you, Mr. Comptroller. I believe,
and of course the members of the evaluation committee and the expert are best able to address this, but I believe it's all in the way that the two offerors reflected how they demonstrated what their profit would be, and I believe they just used two entirely different methods, if that's correct.
In a sense, it is. It's just, I think that we've made it abundantly clear, I guess, in I guess through the procurement process, that there'd be no other. I mean, all profits are disclosed, all sources of revenue are disclosed to the state and fully auditable by the state. And you said there's in the, as you've noted, sir, that this is a very complex business, and there are a number of ways that PBMs offer prepare their pricing, and it really varies from PBM to PBM. So there are multiple methodologies out there for when PBM is presenting its cost to you, and given the state's transparency requirements, the admin fee really is the source of profit. And there are other places where there are potential for the PBMs to make profit in mail order, for example. But those are all fully disclosed to the state and well vetted through the process.
Well, I'm all for the state saving money. It just strikes me that there's a possibility here, and a pretty strong one, that we may not be saving money. And, Madam Secretary, in these bids, I would put these proposals out. If you're going to say at the end it's a cost consideration that's going to outweigh the technical, I suggest that we just go ahead and do that. What I'm complaining about here is the inconsistency. I remember the ARINC contract, which we had here, where we had a great Maryland-based company that was the low bidder, $40 million less than Motorola, a big out-of-state company, and we decided to go with the technical thing and take it away from the Maryland company that was the low bidder. Here we've got, the Maryland company ranks higher in technical, and we based on these cost considerations, we're going to take it from the incumbent, and there's going to be a lot of, obviously, transition disruption that goes on. It's not your fault or the ESI's fault. It's just inevitable. And all I'm asking for isn't, can't we get some consistency where businesses that come and apply for these things are not going to feel like they're in a subjective process where, the strike zone can change at any point. And when you've got a $2.4 billion contract, I would, I can kind of sympathize with businesses that say, where is the, are we changing, are these rules subject to change in midstream? So, anyway, I'm...
Mr. Comptroller, let me just reiterate.
Delighted to hear the Secretary's response.
Yes, and let me reiterate for the third time. The RFP provided for the technical and the financial to be equal, and that's exactly what we did. I mean, I think if we're looking at what the Board of Contract Appeals said, I think, first of all, I just want to point out and reiterate that they did uphold DBM's actions in awarding to Express Scripts. If we're going to talk about some of the many things that they said, in their opinion, the board described the evaluation process as thorough. They described it as careful, thoughtful, and well-reasoned. And the board recognized that DBM performed admirably during the course of a large, multi-layer, and complex procurement. So I think, that's the other side of the story here, is that this was looked at carefully. We started out with these proposals getting equal technical and financial consideration, and that's the way we ended up.
Well, I would strongly recommend everyone to read that opinion themselves, because I found it to be very troubling. But let me switch to Walgreens, if I could, because apparently Walgreens drugstores are no longer part of the winning, the company you want to award the contract to. For the record, how many Walgreens stores are currently open in Maryland, and how many plan subscribers currently get their prescriptions filled at local Walgreens?
Well, if I could start this off by saying, you know, one of the things that the RFP did was it just required that a bidder's network have at least one pharmacy within a certain number of miles of 98% of participants' homes. We didn't get into making any determination about who should be in that network. And I think for us, the bottom line was that Express Scripts came forward with a network that exceeded our 98% requirement.
Okay. So how many Walgreens stores are there, and how many plan subscribers currently get their prescriptions filled?
According to the information I have, Walgreens has 58 pharmacies in Maryland, but at the same time, Express Scripts has almost 1,200 pharmacies in its network.
Okay. And how many of our plan people currently use Walgreens? I only ask this because I get my prescriptions at CVS. So I go down to the pharmacy, and I get my whatever it is once a month that I need. But if those guys told me I had to go to another CVS, even within the same system, I'd balk. I'd say, no way. I've been coming here for 10 years, gone, and I know my pharmacist. I know my drugstore, and, I don't trust the other pharmacist, even though he's a CVS guy. Here you're saying to people, no, you have to go to a completely different chain. And I don't think it's as easy as you suggest. I assume there are quite a few people that are going to be affected. And
well,
so I find it hard to believe. Is Walgreens represented here?
Well, why don't you let Ms. Simmons answer your question?
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
In the terms that I use, there are 32,000 belly buttons that are impacted, that use Walgreens. I count doorbells as family units and belly buttons as everybody that's in that family unit.
I can't say that at this point. I've ever quite heard of an organization of belly buttons.
Well, of those 32,000...
So those doorbells and belly buttons.
Yes, that's right.
So would the doorbells be a subset of your belly button number, or the belly button be a subset of your doorbell number?
The belly button is a subset of your doorbell. So it's the belly buttons behind your doorbell.
Gotcha.
Okay. So of those 32,000, 61% of those members using Walgreens also fill their prescriptions at other pharmacies. So they are not seeing Walgreens exclusively. And additionally, if you turn around and look around, there may be a Walgreens on this corner, but there's going to be a CVS, a Rite Aid, a Target, a Costco, a Giant pharmacy on any of the other corners. And I spoke with the benefits director in Baltimore City, who had a similar transition, and they indicated that ESI was extremely helpful in assisting members with transferring from one pharmacy to the other. There's also a myriad of advertisements and posters up from all the other pharmacies saying, hey, we accept Express Scripts and we will certainly help you transfer your prescription. So, yes, there will be some disruption, but I believe that it will be well mitigated.
And I think what's key is they're going to have one pharmacy within 3 miles for urban areas, one within 5 miles for suburban areas, and one pharmacy within 10 miles for rural areas.
Which was indeed the provision in the RFP.
Which exceeds the provision that was in the RFP.
Okay, but just for the record, how many belly buttons were there you were talking about? 32,000. Okay. Madam Secretary, when did we get word that there was going to be a possible problem with ESI and Walgreens?
I beg your pardon?
When did you first become aware of the problems between Walgreens and Express Scripts, that they were about to have a rupture, I guess, in their relationship? And when you learned that, did it cause you to have any reassessment of your support for the contract?
I think it's when we learned that there were discussions going on, I think my staff immediately began to look into how many of our members could potentially be impacted. But I think for us, the overall driving factor was the fact, again, based on the requirements that we had put forth in the RFP, Express Scripts exceeded the RFP access requirements. So we were comfortable with the fact of whether Walgreens was in or out of the network, that we would have adequate facilities to serve our members.
Okay. And it doesn't surprise you that they hear the 32,000 figure?
The 32,000, as we indicated, were ones that we knew that used did use Walgreens, but as Ms. Timmons indicated, 61% of them didn't use it exclusively.
Is Walgreens here? Can you come up and identify yourself, please? You heard my questions. Are we? What is the? I guess is the data correct about the number of pharmacies and the disruption, the belly buttons, and this, that, and the other thing?
Governor, we have a very significant presence. My name is Jeff Berkowitz from Walgreens. We have a very significant presence in the state of Maryland, 58 stores, close to 1,000 employees, 350,000 prescriptions on an annual basis. I think from an access perspective, what you're hearing from the consultants is that every retail pharmacy and the practice of pharmacy is the same no matter where you go. And I think that has been a big part of the dialogue between Express Scripts and Walgreens, is that there is a value proposition with a Walgreens pharmacist that also provides a significant savings that has not been taken into account, with a focus on overall medical and healthcare costs versus just the focus on the drug spend specifically, which has not been taken into account. I think also we haven't discussed the issue of 24-hour pharmacies in the state. So there are about 36, a third of which are Walgreens pharmacies, and they represent a very significant component of the RXs with 24-hour pharmacies. In terms of the disruption, we believe anecdotally, again, we're in a very unprecedented space in retail pharmacy. There's always been near universal access, and there is very, very limited uptake of what this would be, which is a narrow network that doesn't include one of the large national chains. We're at less than 40 days into that disruption, so we really don't know exactly what it means. We hear anecdotally that there are all sorts of issues. Certainly you raised one, which is the very valuable relationship between a patient and their pharmacist. And we see 6 million patients a day on a national basis that come through our doors. And we believe that relationship between the pharmacist and the patient and the consumer is critically important to their healthcare. We are hearing anecdotally that folks that are going to other pharmacists are either not getting full prescriptions filled, or they are being asked to come back in a couple of days. We hear anecdotally that people are going back to their physicians for new prescriptions, so there is a very important cost consideration here in the disruption, because people aren't just transferring over the prescriptions. They're going back to their physicians and getting new prescriptions. They're losing their pharmacy history in the way that those are being transferred over as well.
Well, I mentioned my relationship with my own pharmacist. It's everybody's got that. And so the 61%, they go to two different pharmacies. I don't know who they are, but they're not my universe, that's for sure, because, it's a comfort level and it's loyalty. You mentioned cost savings. I'm not aware of that. But what is the, because you have a different situation, but what is the status of talks between you and ESI, and is there any hope of negotiating an end, or is it just to the stalemate, or is the
sure
relationship just the irreconcilable?
The contract expired on December 31st. We had originally announced in June of 2011 that there was a very real chance that Walgreens would not be participating in the Express Scripts network, and we haven't had very productive conversations since that time, and there's certainly been no conversations in the calendar year of 2012 related to this issue. And ultimately what you're getting, again, which was not part of the process, was a restricted network with a large national chain not participating, which again was not anticipated in the process here.
And what is your officer? What is your title?
I'm the Senior Vice President of Pharmaceutical Development and Market Access for Walgreens.
Well, great. Thank you for appearing here. And then if I could just ask, Madam Secretary, the move to generics, is that part of this contract?
to move to generics. I'm going to defer to Ann Timmons, who's head of employee benefits.
In other words, I, going back to my own experience, some of my prescriptions cost for a 90-day supply $1.18. I'm stunned when I have to pay, you know, basically pay with change in my pocket. Other prescriptions cost $80, $90, $100. Obviously, it's the generic brand that costs the lesser amount. Is there a, in this RFP or this contract we're approving today, are there demands? Like, I am demanding my agency get more e-filed tax returns because it's a good idea. Is there a demand in this contract that the generics be increased from whatever they are to double?
Well, under our contract, the PBM is certainly tasked with improving our generic dispense rate, and they have various ways of doing that through targeted outreach to members as
prescribers.
What about
ESI? Are they under any contractual obligation to increase the percentage of generics?
Neither party is required to increase it, but it is certainly part of our expectations.
Well, I don't know whether Catalyst is allowed to speak, but my understanding of their success was due in part to a significant increase in use of generics, which saves the state a lot of money. And once again, $1.18 versus $87, I'm just picking two different examples.
We love generics, absolutely, sir. There's a number of things happening in the marketplace that influences generic utilization. First off, is this, you know, as materials roll off of patent and become generically available. I mean, this most recent change of Lipitor to a generic status is a windfall for it'll be huge savings for plan sponsors. The one of the largest drivers in that is just that, as the FDA approves and things come off into a generic status. That is a very, very large driver of that.
Commissioner, Walgreens has the highest generic dispensing rate of any retail pharmacy in the country. And interestingly enough, Express Scripts has recently signed a deal, although Lipitor has gone off patent and is available generically. They've signed a deal with Pfizer to issue the branded product for the first 6 months of generic entry versus the generic that is now available. So they partnered with the branded pharmaceutical company versus allowing
the
generic.
I beg to differ that Walgreens is not the largest dispenser of generics for our plan. In fact, they're ranked 4 in the state. So they are not.
Well, why don't we, if I could, ask Mr. Blair, he's back there, if he can come up and speak about anything he wants to say.
Mr. Blair is the CEO of the incumbent.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm David Blair, the chairman and CEO of Catalyst. And clearly we've been proud to serve the Maryland employees' independence for the past 5 years. Certainly as a Maryland company that started here 10 years ago with, you know, two employees and this idea that we could deliver local solutions with transparency and be a fiduciary. And today we'll have annualized revenues of over $6 billion. I think the results for the state of Maryland employees speak for themselves, and I appreciate the kind words about our ability to drive generic utilization up 25%. Over the past 5 years, we've exceeded our network discounts and rebates over the past several years by $40 million, so above and beyond the guarantees, and numerous other clinical programs that have saved the state tens of millions of dollars. And, of course, that didn't happen by accident, right? We have local pharmacists and account managers right here in Maryland that meet with your top prescribing doctors and your members and your pharmacists on a regular basis.
That's part of the contract, isn't it? To have people on site here.
That's certainly part of our commitment.
Yes.
Come back up.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to clarify the question that having people on site in Maryland, that is that or is that not part of the contract, part of the RFP?
We have on our current contract, there are two pharmacists that are dedicated to our account, and they do meet with the top 100 prescribers under our plan. However, as part of the pharmacy directorship and other quarterly reporting that we get, we've been unable to get any documented proof of any effectiveness of that, unfortunately, of their work to bring down to increase our generic utilization.
Okay, but the number of pharmacists, the way the contract is executed, is part, I assume, of the contract. That's great. That's true.
Could I just ask that? So how many employees is Express Scripts going to hire in Maryland?
I think at the present time, the proposal
contract
provides for 5 dedicated employees, which is the same as what the incumbent has.
Which is the same as what?
The same number, 5.
Five
dedicated employees to this account.
And I take it this statement that generic use is going up 25%, that's not something you guys agree with?
Well, really, that speaks to going all the way back to the contract that Caremark had and goes back. That's a starting point of year 2005, so that's more than 5 years, really.
And there have been a number of material drugs that have gone to generic status through the normal course of events as patents expire.
Okay. So Mr. Blair was speaking.
I just comment on the number of employees in Maryland. One of our commitments to the state as well was to maintain our corporate headquarters here in Maryland along with this contract. So obviously there's a much bigger economic impact. I think there was someone from Towson, the professor of economics there, did a study. I think it was like $110 million benefit to the state on an annualized basis. I don't want to debate our track record. Obviously, we are very perplexed with this procurement process. We have over 40 state and local governments across the country, and I've scratched my head more on this one than any other procurement process. The 78-page opinion really speaks for itself, and I'm not going to belabor that and go through those items. But candidly, what's most troubling to me today is this Walgreens issue, and let me just elaborate on that and why it's such a problem. And it's not about access, right? This isn't an access issue because those 32,000 belly buttons, I think, will be able to find another pharmacy. They can walk across the street to your CVS and find another pharmacy. So it's not an access issue. This is an issue about evaluating the bids on a level playing field. And I know that's what the state wants to do. And so all three bidders, right, all three offers, when they submitted their proposals, they bid an open network. And there was like 12 questions about your pharmacy network. Do you have all the major chains? How many pharmacies do you have by county? What's the member disruption going to be? There was a huge focus on network. And the reason there was is because the state said this is the second most important thing from a technical perspective, the size of your network and member access. So Catalyst and Express Scripts and Envision, the other offer, they all bid these open networks because that was obviously very important. We didn't have to do that because the requirements were much, much lower than that. We only had to have one pharmacy within every 3 miles in urban areas, one in every 5 miles for suburban areas. So we could have taken out 2 networks, maybe even 3 networks, and still met that minimum access requirements. Okay, so but why didn't the bidders do that, right? Because we wanted to score very well from a technical perspective. That's what we were trying to do because that's so important to Maryland. Maryland wants access. So all three bidders bid an open network. I think in Express Scripts proposal it said we have all major national chains. We have 97% of the pharmacies in Maryland. Now, why would a PBM offer a limited network, right? Because we could have. We could have put it in our proposal, we exclude Walgreens or somebody else. Because as you limit the network, your discounts go up, right? If I go to CVS and I say, I'm going to exclude Walgreens from my network, guess what CVS does? Bigger discount. You narrow the network, you get bigger discounts. And so why I'm so perplexed, right, as a Maryland guy, Maryland resident, Maryland company, as your fiduciary, Nobody calls me up and says, hey, David, I want to make sure we're comparing apples to apples. If we took Walgreens out of your network, what would the discount be? Would you get a better discount? Yes. 3 to 4% better. So I could totally wipe out any perceived pricing disadvantage if we eliminated a major chain like Walgreens. And then you get the number one technical proposal and the best pricing. And so, very much disappointed, very much perplexed about how it never occurred to us, and nobody ever told us, that we could bid an open network for the technical evaluation. We have everybody. But then submit a limited network for pricing. Never occurred to us to do that. Never told that we could do that. So I would urge the board, if you're not going to rebid this, you must reevaluate it. Ask Catalyst, ask the other PBM, hey, what would our pricing be for a limited network? And make sure that the state is indeed getting the best proposal.
Any response to that, Secretary Foster? Did you all look at that?
I think we've looked at everything.
Closed network, open network. Well, what Mr. Blair says is, if he was allowed to dump Walgreens, he could have given us a benefit that was a superior price, and he already had the superior technical. How about the people we paid a lot of money to evaluate this? You want to respond to that one?
Mr. Governor, at the time of the request for proposals, all the bidders indeed were instructed to quote an open network, and in fact we received quotes or guarantees, contract provisions for an open network. Those provisions are still the provisions that we're applying for projecting this contract forward. Absolutely correct. If you do say a limited network, that will change the pricing. That's absolutely true. However, that is not. We don't have a closed network. We have an open network. There is a one chain has chosen not to participate. We don't have a chain under contract. ESI does not. And ESI's pricing currently is evaluating, as it were, as if Walgreens was still there.
How can you say
we
that?
How can you say that? They did not provide, or they did not give us revised discounting information or revised contractual terms based upon the fact that Walgreens was no longer in the network.
Yeah, but what if they knew that? Obviously, there's been this impending divorce. This is not something that just popped up right at the end. And so, you know, how can you say that as a, you know, to us saying, this company that you want us to give this contract to isn't factoring this into their bid.
If I could kind of interject for a second. I think we've heard from Walgreens, we've heard from Catalyst. It may be good in this environment for us to hear from ESI and for them to respond to Walgreens' version of what happened and what happens with the network.
Can they respond to that question then? The last one.
Yeah.
And about how can you evaluate it as if Walgreens in it when Walgreens isn't in it? And then I didn't quite follow that.
It's the pricing, sir. What we evaluated in the proposals when we solicited the quotations, that was prior to
the
issues that developed between Walgreens and ESI. I believe the best and final offers were gathered prior to that. So at that point, we had the pricing in place that was offered, and it's still the same best and final pricing that was offered prior to any of this happening. So if
the absence of Walgreens from their network actually results in improvements for them, those dollars get passed through to the state.
Your assertion would be that
if Walgreens were not in that network, that they would pass on a greater discount with fewer
if they were to renegotiate, I do not believe our pricing, the pricing they've offered us, hasn't been adjusted to reflect not having Walgreens in the network.
But that's in terms of the guarantees.
That's in terms of the guarantees.
However, if there are actual
reductions in cost, the state benefits from those.
Well, it doesn't make sense. We just heard from Mr. Blair that's how profits are moved up and down, based on the network. And let me just ask this while I've got you here, because I guess we're going to move on to.
I'm sorry, but was he going to answer?
You just heard that this is a very important sponge in their whole corporate way of. Obviously, they have to make money. They're a private company.
But on this state's contract, the money is made off the administrative fee, not off of the
differences in pricing, right?
That all gets passed through to the state.
Well, I'm going to ask Mr. Blair that, because I think, frankly, they and ESI are a lot more expert than, with all due respect, AG is on this. And I just, if I could ask this, are you aware of any other state that's entering a contract like this with such a gaping hole in the distribution network?
I don't think that we tend to believe that there is a gaping hole in the network.
You guys are the national consultants.
He can talk to the market.
West Virginia, for example, right next door is contracting with ESI and has done so for the past number of years. So we have the same issue there. I think that from what we've been finding out from the industry that this trends, this lack of having Walgreens in the networks has been fairly well mitigated by the efforts of ESI to make sure that the members aren't disrupted, to make sure that the records are readily available to and transition to new pharmacies. So from what we've been finding in the field, sir, that has been very well mitigated by ESI.
I mean, I think the bottom line is that network pharmacies change all the time. It's negotiations with the pharmacies is what determines who's in the network. And that's a change.
Well, let me ask this then. What percentage of 24-hour pharmacies in Maryland are Walgreens?
Bottom line was, a part of this contract, we did not ask to have 24-hour service. That's not an industry standard, and it's not one that we included in our RFP. And the reason we didn't include it is because what we did find was, in regard to 24-hour pharmacists, the basic thing is that between 10 and 7 a.m., they're basically filling prescriptions from the prior day. Okay.
Well, I don't know. If you're going to bring ASI, I want Mr. Blair to come back and just respond to this, because then I misheard what he was saying, which is that it's a...
Well, I think as the vendor who we're recommending for award, you have heard from everyone else. It may be helpful to hear from ESI.
Okay.
Gemma, could you introduce yourself?
Sure.
For the record, and your name and your position.
Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, my name is Ron Tyson, and I'm Vice President, Signature Accounts for Express Script. Worked in the pharmacy benefit management area for 24 years, and the state of Maryland is very important to us. It's true that we are a Missouri-based company. We also house a subsidiary in Maryland, ConnectuCare, that employs Marylanders, and we're dedicated to having an account team in Maryland that's actually Maryland residents, as well as supporting Maryland-based subcontractors through the course of this contract. The question that you ask about Walgreens. When we bid this contract, we bid the contract with guaranteed pricing. And the guaranteed pricing that we put out in the bid actually assumed at that time that Walgreens was going to be in the network. By the time the contract had been reviewed and awarded, actually at the time of award, well, we had still anticipated that Walgreens would be part of the network. And in June of last year, Walgreens came to us, and 6 months in advance of when their contract was going to expire, and advised us that they would be terminating the contract in December of that year. The state requires that 98% of the members have access to a pharmacy in the state. We exceed those requirements by 99.34%, which is by a wide margin. The state also has selected an open network, and this open network, any pharmacy can be a part of the network that chooses to, Walgreens has chosen not to participate in our network because it thinks it deserves higher prices than any other pharmacy chain in the country. What we've seen over the past few months with our clients is that they disagree. Adding Walgreens makes virtually no measurable difference to member access or convenience, and they only represent about 5% of the nearly 1,200 pharmacies in Maryland. There is another network store within 1 mile for 52 of the 58 Walgreens in Maryland. We moved millions of people away from Walgreens over the past several months with virtually no patient disruption. In regards to 24 access, since that issue actually came up, we have a network pharmacy 24-hour location within 8 miles of any 24-hour Walgreens store, and only about 1% of all prescriptions filled overnight. For most of those prescriptions filled are not necessarily for emergencies. Chains are open 24 hours, as the secretary said, because they fill next day scripts that are actually left into the pharmacy. For example, the Eastern Walgreens location submitted an average of less than one script per night to ESI in 2011. In regards to the discounts that we laid out in the original proposal, we did not modify those discounts once we learned that Walgreens was going to be leaving the network. We left the discounts as is. This is a pass-through arrangement in the network pharmacy, in the network pharmacy portion of the contract. And if we achieve greater savings as a result of Walgreens being out of the network, those savings are passed on to the state. They are not retained by Express Scripts. So we left. We made no modifications to the pricing that was proposed.
So you're basically a not-for-profit.
I'm sorry?
You're basically a not-for-profit company?
No, it's not that we're a not-for-profit. I mean, most companies have a profitability component. What I'm saying is, in the network arena, the proposal, as it was laid out, required that the network pharmacies be passed through pricing. So what we pay to the retail pharmacies is what the state pays. And we did not alter or modify those numbers once we learned that Walgreens was going to no longer be in the network.
Okay. Well, I'm just trying to figure out how you make your money, because it seems as if everything is passed through at cost to the state. And your statement is that if there are any things that are we're unaware of because of events happening, that's all going to pass through also. So I guess the question I have is, Catalyst claims they baked in a profit that was transparent. You guys didn't, and had some kind of confidential phone call afterwards to explain where your profit came from. Is that in writing, or is there some
basis
that we can be assured that your proposal included everything that Catalyst proposal included, and that we're not sitting here, as I say, possibly signing off on a long-term contract where we're not going to save any money?
What I can tell you is that we have guaranteed you rates in this contract. We've given full audit rights to make sure that we're complying with those rates, and that the rates that we proposed in the contract are the rates that still stand. And there's transparency for you to be able to audit and ensure that we're held to the terms of the contract.
And I think in terms of, if I can just speak up and not to get into any specifics, I think basically profits are recovered through the administrative fees, which are based on a per member, per script, per member, per month fee. And that's essentially where the profits come from.
Well, no, I don't have anything against ESI. You're a big national company. But my concern here is that we're displacing a Maryland company that, frankly, did very well in technical and claims that their price is better than yours if you compare apples to apples. And I referenced the Arendt contract some time ago, another huge $800 million contract where we did exactly the opposite. And the only consistent thing between those two decisions was that the Maryland-based company had their business yanked away. And there's a pattern here that I don't like. It's not the inconsistency between the technical and the financial matters. It's the indifference, I guess, that we have in the state facing these Maryland companies that do a tremendous job for us and bid for our business and feel as if the balls and strikes are being changed. It's not anything to do with you guys. You're just coming into this, but it's a troubling pattern, I guess, and I hope that I'm wrong, and I hope that you know, all of this is going to be resolved, because I don't think I'm going to have two votes on the board, but, you know.
Mr. Comptroller, I'll just reiterate now for the fourth time that we looked at this. We looked at the technical. We looked at the financial. We looked at them on an equal basis. The department is recommending that the contract be awarded to ESI because we believe overall that that provides the best value to the state.
Madam
Secretary, we would recommend that the board and ask you to approve that.
I agree, and I appreciate that. But let me ask, with all due respect, have you read
I read all 78 pages. Yes, I did.
And what was... Did anything jump out at you?
I think what jumped out at me is throughout the opinion that they proceeded to, the board agreed that the evaluation process was thorough, it was careful, it was thoughtful, it was well-reasoned. And in the end, the board made a decision to deny the Catalyst appeal and uphold the department's decision. And I would ask that the board do the same.
How about the Express Script guys before we get to dinner time? Express Script want to be heard?
They were.
Any more?
Yes,
anybody else?
Do you want to, just in the dying embers here of this, Mr. Blair, do you have any? Because I thought your statement was quite cogent, that we're comparing apples to oranges here.
Mr. Comptroller, I would just reiterate what I said earlier about the Walgreens, which is it's not an access issue. All three bidders represented that they had all major networks in their pharmacy because we all wanted to get good technical scores. My guess is if Express Scripts hadn't had Walgreens in, their technical scores wouldn't have been as high because we all wanted to represent that we had no member disruption. And so now you're getting a limited network, and in the pricing that candidly reflects what an open network would be. And I think it's incumbent upon the board, if we're not going to rebid this, reevaluate it because, as I said earlier, I know if I eliminate a major chain like Walgreens, I'll get you 3 to 4% better savings and eliminate the pricing discrepancy. And I would just conclude with, as you think about the overall cost to Maryland from a health perspective, it will be much more driven by utilization. Are our members compliant? Are we keeping your diabetic population testing themselves? Are we keeping them out of the ER? Are physicians prescribing generic drugs? Are we promoting over-the-counter products when appropriate? And so from a technical perspective, I think clearly Catalyst is better positioned, and as reflected in ranking highest out of 5 of the 6 categories from a technical perspective, to drive lower costs while also improving care.
David, given the large amount of this contract and given the margin by which the competitor, challenger, beat you on price, and given the fact that you are a very valued Maryland-headquartered and Maryland-located firm, why could you not have beaten them on price for another $50 million?
Excuse me,
102, whatever it's projected in the models to work out.
So Governor, We're one of the fastest-growing companies in the country because we've been able to offer low discounts and low administrative fees. And so we've been very perplexed by why we didn't have the lowest pricing. And so there was a lot of confusion around this brand generic algorithm, which we won't get into today. But now when I look at it and you say, David, if you could exclude one major chain, well, there you go. So now you could compare apples to apples. Give Catalyst a chance to exclude one major chain, let us resubmit our pricing, and then compare. Because then you truly are comparing apples to apples versus right now it's apples to oranges.
Happy to move that.
A best and final offer?
Yeah,
already
exactly.
Had
do it again.
You know, the only thing about it at this point is you're really saying that you're going to open this up where we've really had an exposure and of... A lot of information has gone to the board, and I mean, this is
a lot of information has gone to Walgreens apparently too.
And the only standard for this board of public works is doing whatever is in the best interest of the state. And, so I'm happy to, Governor, Treasurer. I think this is troubling. I think we should take a look at least the assessment or try to find whether this is at all true. We have these consultants, I guess, if we can ask to look at it. But I'm not comfortable voting for this based on the statements that we've heard today. And this board has a very important responsibility, according to the statutes and constitution of the state, which is to do exactly what we're doing right now, determining whether this is a good deal for Maryland.
But I think what we've done is we've had a lot of open discussion about this. We've had pricing and bidding strategies discussed in public. I think obviously this puts us in a position where you're just informing the bidding process.
Well, it sounds like you're going back to...
I don't see how that works without going through the whole thing again. Does it? I mean,
we can't reevaluate this now. It would really mean that we'd have to go back and rebid this. Rebidding this now, I think, would be unfair to all the offers to participating. I think rebidding this now will have a chilling effect on competition on state contracts. And the bottom line is going to further delay this contract for 3 years.
Why would it delay it for three years?
Well, it would delay it for three plan years. We'd have 1 year to do the procurement and probably 1 year to relitigate this again. And we've already had a 1 year delay in this contract.
Right. Let me ask the Attorney General. So if you want to chime in on that whole Mr. Blair's suggestion that it could just be reevaluated without being rebid, would you address that for us here, for the generalists who compose this board?
Thank you. The problem is that we've already had the best and final offers and a recommendation for award. What I think the board can do is accept or reject, approve or not approve. That's the choice we're faced with now. And if the board chooses not to approve, then we have to restart the procurement process. And that's, I think, what the Secretary was referring to in terms of creating another delay. It took us quite a long time to bring this to the point of recommending an award. Presumably, we would have to go through that process again. It would, in effect, be an extension, I gather, of the contract to Catalyst for another year or two or perhaps three. And frankly, that calls into question the fairness of the procurement process if we were to do that. And it would probably hurt competition for any contracts in Maryland if vendors think that there's no end to the process, and then incumbents are given an enormous advantage.
And Mr. Blair, you shared information with Walgreens, right, about the stuff that came, you know, that was part of the big package here, right?
Yes, I've had conversations.
Right. And I have a hard time believing that Walgreens here because you want to be left out of both of the successful bidders. That kind of stretches credulity. You didn't take the time to be here because you want to be left out of both contracts. No. Okay. All right. I don't think we've had a contract that's been gone over more than this one.
But, Governor, I think the gentleman from ESI.
I just wanted to make a quick point about the it almost sounds like the gentleman from Catalyst is asserting that we had an advantage in the process because we could have put better pricing out there without Walgreens in the network. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to bring it back to the point that the pricing that was proposed when this RFP was done assumed that Walgreens was in place, and we made no modifications to that pricing once the award was made, and in June of last year when we learned that Walgreens was going to no longer be part of the network. It could go either way. We have proposed guarantees, so when the bid was evaluated, it was evaluated as an apples-to-apples comparison, assuming Walgreens was in place. I think going back and changing the pricing now, just because Walgreens is out, doesn't make sense in the sense of how the bid was originally evaluated.
Well, yeah, but with all due respect, it's a completely different environment. I mean, there's an enormous hole in the distribution network that they claim would have significantly adjusted their situation. And you guys, I don't know what your position is as far as your how you make your money. But, Governor, let me just say that I think one of the problems here is that we've had such a difficult time evaluating the cost proposals because we have not gotten the data given to members of the board. It's been encrypted. It's been given to us under, you know, if you tell anybody about this, we're going to have to get rid of you. It's everything is like temporarily shared with staff at meetings. It all arrives late. It's all basically incomprehensible. And so I think that the many of the problems were that could have been avoided in this if we'd gotten a, at least for members of the board, a transparent transferal of analysis and data. And I'm going to vote no against the contract. I think there's a significant chance that there is no, will be no savings, in fact, significant costs to the state of Maryland, a lot of disruption. Maryland-based company has done a great job, according to everybody, is going to get left at the door. And, you know, I think a lot of it could have been avoided if we'd had, you know, full disclosure, if things hadn't been blacked out and acted as if they're top secret. You get the redacted statement, there's nothing proprietary in it. It's just had an opinion from one of the evaluators that exactly what I'm saying is true.
Is there any statement that hasn't been provided to you? Any redaction that hasn't been
provided? Yeah, but it's all been dripped.
Any time that hasn't been allowed to you to reevaluate or read this or read the full statement?
All I'm saying is that the situation, and basically my staff, Governor, you know, it's been a difficult process. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that could be avoided in the future and less redaction and more transparency.
Madam Treasurer, your thoughts, closing thoughts here?
Yeah, the comptroller suggests we all read this opinion. I've read it several times. I read it quite thoroughly. Actually, I don't want you to think that I didn't. As the gentleman knows, come from Chicago and am very fond of Walgreens. I'm sorry Walgreens chose not to be part of the network, and we have lost their at the moment, 58 stores out of over 1,100. Hope they'll come back. But I don't think that's what this contract is about at all. It's almost a year. It's a year next month that we first saw this contract, and we were asked to withhold judgment until it went to the Board of Contract Appeals, which we did. The Board of Contract Appeals has looked at it and unanimously agreed that the decision was an appropriate one. I don't know whether the taxpayers will be saving $100 million or more, but I do know that it's very important. And most importantly, I know, Governor, that you were very concerned, the comptroller and I, about the procurement process itself. I wish the Maryland-based firm had been best on cost. I think it would have been great, but they gave it their best shot, and they weren't. And I see no reason to think that the process wasn't appropriate. I see a lot of reasons to think that they were. I appreciate anecdotal evidence, but I recognize it is anecdotal evidence, and we can get anecdotes from almost anybody we see. I see no reason after all this time, and I am pleased. I'm happy for Catalyst. They got an extra year out of the contract, so they got the full 5 years. But I see no reason to right now upset the entire procurement process and not award the contract as the department, the evaluators, the department, and the Board of Contract Appeals indicate are appropriate.
I've rarely been involved in the 6 years here in a contract that was poured over more than this one.
with the experts that were retained by Department of Budget Management, with the due process that was not only granted, extended, the openness of this latest of several hearings here today. And I agree with the Treasurer, nothing would have made me happier than for this Maryland company to have been able to have won this on price, especially given the size of this contract. This is one of the bigger, more complex procurements that we do. Let me just touch for a moment on Maryland businesses. We, of course, want to maximize the opportunities for Maryland businesses in our state contracting. And our commitment to Maryland businesses is reflected in the fact that in calendar year 2011, 863 of the 1,077 contracts that the Board of Public Works approved were awarded to Maryland resident businesses. We value each and every one of them. There is no job more important than the next job that we create. This is a procurement process that has been a long time coming. When this was awarded in the prior administration, it was hard fought, and there were delays in implementation. And given the amount of dollars that pass through this contract on a monthly basis, every aspect of due process was wrung out of it, of that procurement process years ago, so I understand. I don't have personal recollection. And that's what's happened in this case. The Board of Contract Appeals found that Express Scripts met the requirements of both the RFP and the Maryland law on using a subsidiary to satisfy the various requirements here. The board recognized that the Catalyst also planned to use wholly owned subsidiaries and affiliated companies to perform its work under the contract. On the evaluation, I'm not going to touch on that one, but the evaluation committee looked at the criteria, the algorithms that were placed out there, things to which no one objected on at the outset. The bottom line conclusion of the Board of Contract Appeals was that that they found that the DBM actually, the Department of Budget Management, had conducted a very professional and very exhaustive procurement process, and that they followed the law in this case. It was a, quote, large, multi-layered, and complex procurement. And although the board criticized DBM on a few matters, it ultimately rejected all of the claims that have been made so well and presented so well by the various lawyers and advocates for Catalyst, including their own very distinguished and honorable CEO. Throughout the opinion, the board described the evaluation process as, quote, thorough, quote, careful, quote, thoughtful, quote, well-reasoned. And while no procurement process is perfect, the board recognized the Board of Contract Appeals recognized the Department of Budget Management performed admirably. I might also add that a few meetings ago, we were told that if we just allow this to go to the Board of Contract Appeals and allow us to make this case in the fullness of time, that is all that we are asking for. We have done that, and we have done more, and I believe that the Department of Budget Management has acted in good faith with the counsel, the Attorney General's office, and with the other experts here. And I will move approval of this matter.
Second.
Seconded by the Treasurer. All in favor, signal by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All opposed?
No.
Controller votes no for a form stated reasons. Thank you all very, very much.